So thank all of you for coming. I'm going to record the lecture for the 21st of September. That's next Monday. Lecture number 7 on controlled names and controlled vocabularies. This is a lecture which you've already seen a lot of in the 202 and the news stories, because many of the issues really are about the lack of controlled names and controlled vocabularies. We'll start with a pretty important question, namely, what is a name? And then talk about the difference between naturally occurring names and controlled names, sort of controlled and uncontrolled vocabularies. Talk about a number of issues like authority control, that is, what it means to have an authoritative or official or master name. And then we'll talk a bit about name matching, and you saw some of that in the Operation Clean Data case study. So, I like to find comics when I can. This is one from Pearls Before Swine that came out a few months ago. Essentially, it's the kind of everyday example where we have miscommunication because people use words to mean same words that mean different things and different words that mean the same things. And I'm not going to read it to you, but you can get a smile out of this. I'm sure that you think that venti is as funny as I do when you go to a Starbucks restaurant. This is really called the vocabulary problem in the kind of scientific literature. The idea that people use a large number of words for the same thing or concept. And what's interesting about this is that everybody's surprised by this when they see the actual data. Because the fact that the words you use are the ones you use means that they're natural to you. But in fact, there's an extreme variability in word selection, and that's an inescapable fact, because what's natural to you may not be natural to me. So when we ask ourselves what a name is, I mean, names are simply labels for something or some category that distinguishes one thing from another. We have a vocabulary for talking about names. We can say that a thing or category can have multiple names, that is, that they are synonyms or aliases. Sometimes different things can have the same names, that means they could be homonyms, where the same sound pattern is used to describe different things. We all might call these polysemes, where you have there are different senses that are somewhat incompatible for the same word. So let me give you examples. Bank for money and bank for river are homonyms because they're two words that have different senses. Shipping container is polysemous in the sense that there are many different things which are shipping containers, which are very different things, but they're all shipping containers. We'll see that in a picture in a few minutes. And finally, if a name is used to refer to something that is unique in some context, it's an identifier. And the key thing there is in some context, because we are unlikely to ever have global unique identifiers, but we're unlikely to ever really need them that way. So, why do we need controlled vocabulary? Well, we need them because naturally occurring vocabulary is not controlled. It's because, as we saw in the Lakoff reading, embodied in our context and experiences, words that seem perfectly natural to you will be different or even bad with respect to the words used by other people. So, you know, this is what you use when you have the uncontrolled, limited capacity of the search box. You just type something into a search box and a search engine, and that's an uncontrolled vocabulary. You're not being required to use any particular set of words. And as you can imagine, if you don't use the right words or the words that the person who indexed the documents that are in the collection, you will not have high recall. So, we want to improve recall. We have to use a subset of the words we would normally use or naturally use, and use the words that somehow have been controlled for our use because of the ones that are going to be in the index of the collection. But that begs a lot of questions, like, well, what would a good word look like? Where would it come from? And even if you had them, how would you get people to use them? And it's pretty obvious that we're going to have to work pretty hard at making words good, because they're not going to spontaneously arise. That's the whole point, that people have their own idiosyncratic language, and they're going to use the words that they use. and those are not going to be good necessarily with respect to any particular context of use. Now, so this is called the vocabulary problem, as I've said, and there's a classic paper that I had you read, the Furness et al. Paper. Some researchers at Bell Labs around 1980, who were looking at the problem of how you would design command languages that would work for computer systems. This is when we had, before we had graphical interfaces, we had command lines you would type words into to cause, invoke computer functions on various information objects or function objects. And they were trying to figure out what was being called at the time statistical semantics. That is, let's look at the empirically at the word people use for some particular purpose. So they did six different experiments in which they at how people assign words to things like text editing functions or common objects or how you would categorize household goods, like if you're going to sell them on something like Craigslist or eBay, how you would organize recipes. And they contrasted three different kinds of vocabulary design techniques, which they call the armchair method, naming by voting, and select what I intend. Now, I love this phrase, the armchair method. Why is it called the armchair method? It's when you're sitting in the chair saying, well, let me think of a word for this thing.
Guessing.
All right, you're not guessing because you're coming up with what you think is a good name, but you're doing it without having any consultation with anyone else. And the last time you came up with a set of names or labels for things or you designed APIs or anything, you did exactly that. You sat in your office and said, what should I call these things, these functions, these objects? And when you look at this for these six different experiments, the probability of two people coming up with the same term is pitifully small, ranging from 7% to 18%. That means 1 out of 13 or 1 out of 6, in the best case, will come up with the same word and say, give me the name for this thing. That's pretty bad agreement. Now, if you say, well, let's just do something different. Let's take a look at all the words that people use and see what the most popular ones are. What's the probability that your word was the most popular word? So that's what it would say. Are you good at guessing the most? It's like that TV show where you have to guess the words that everyone else uses for something. And here is somewhat better because the most frequently used word will be better than any old word. But still, the probability of using the most popular word ranges from 15 to 36%, which is still a pretty small proportion of the users. So you might ask, maybe we're doing this problem wrong. Maybe instead of saying, what name should you give to this object or function, we should say, hey, given this word, what would you expect it to mean? What would you expect it to refer to? So that's like, am I selecting what I intend when I use this word? That says we have some repertoire of words we want to find the best mapping to some thing. Now, it turns out that people are a little better at this because if you have, see, what is the best that this word could refer to, in some cases you get as much as 73%. But still, on some of the categories you get very little. And the problem is you've now said, given all the words people the things people would use for this word, well, if I use enough words, I'm going to get it eventually. But the problem is now I'm using a bunch of words. So if you look at this picture from the paper, it says, how many words would you need for any given common object? How many labels would you have to have for this thing in order to have people have a reasonably high probability of being able to know what you're talking about? And while it does eventually get close to, 80%, as the mean rating there, even 20 different words for some common object isn't enough to ensure that you'll have the one that somebody else used. So even 20 different alias terms for the same object isn't enough to guarantee that you got the one you're going to have. So there's a very, very long tail there of the words people will assign to objects or functions. And that's a staggering observation. People just can't believe it. They say, I can only think of three or four. The problem is, so can everybody else. And they're going to be a different three or four. And so people tend to underestimate this problem. And the reason is that because, words tend to be semantically promiscuous. And that's not the word that linguists use, but I think that's a better way to think about it. That is that words will go with any kind of meaning they want. You know, they'll basically bind to all kinds of different meanings and objects. So, and of course, you know, some of those uses will be somewhat metaphorical. So what is a nut, for example? Well, a nut could be something you buy in a hardware store. It could be something you buy in a seed store. It could be some kind of person you think is sort of a wacky person, right? And so on and so on. It could be a slang for part of the male anatomy, all kinds of things, right? So again, there's lots of uses for these things. And, you know, most words have that polysemous property. So one of my favorite examples, it's actually a story that I've heard from a reliable source, has to do with this one here. Here are two things which both could arguably be given the same name of a shipping container. And the story I heard was that somebody sat in his office and said, I need to have you send over some shipping containers for tomorrow. I need four of them. Bring them over to the parking lot tomorrow. And he expected to have the thing on the right show up, and then said the thing on the left show up. So instead of having a little box that you would ship something in, a shipping container, maybe some kind of carton in which you would ship something, he got four of these big metal things that go on container ships showing up in the back of his office. And I guess the way to look at that is to say, you know, when would it have been smart to fix that problem? You know, after the stuff has already showed up in the back of your warehouse, or fixing it before? You would have wanted to ensure that you knew what you would, that you agreed on the use of the word shipping container before you got the things in the back of your warehouse. So, if to quote Sophonius on this, she reminds us that in fact, you know, you organize information by using a special purpose language. You have to invent a language that people will agree on and can use in a consistent way. And essentially, what you do when you organize information is to say what things will get the same names, which things will get the different names. So that's essentially a problem of vocabulary control. What words will I use for what things in order to organize the domain of objects of interest? So a control vocabulary is some standardized set of terms. It could be subject headings, it could be names, it could be classifications, it could be names of places, it could be names of historical areas, it could be names of any kind of domain in which we have standardized the set. So the people who organize the information, assign things to catalogs or categories, index, can essentially increase the recall and precision to identify the things you're describing. Okay? So a control vocabulary can be a content standard. So we could say, when using the Dublin Core to describe a publisher or an author, you have to come from some control set of names, let's say. Okay? Or you have to have a control type of set of formats. You say, well, I want to have a still image or a moving image or a sound recording or whatever these, could be a fixed set of things I want to describe things as in order to make them easier to recall with some precision. So again, this is a very general definition, and it's intended to be because we're going to be seeing over the next couple of weeks that there's actually a very large range of things we would call control vocabularies that basically differ in how much control they exercise on the things being described. So if you think about it, the simplest kind of control vocabulary is simply a dictionary. It says, I'm going to use words, and I'm only going to use the words that come from some fixed set, and they're going to have some definition so I have some conviction that I can explain what they mean. I could have control vocabularies around names. Okay, I could have naming authorities who decide what kind of names you should use. We could have authority control for places. There's a particular word for authority control for places. Does anyone know what it's called? Gazette. A gazetteer. That's close. A gazetteer. All right. Okay. It's a specialized type of control vocabulary for places. Okay. You look it up and they call it the world's places or something like that, right? Okay. You have identifiers, again, which might be unique in some context. We have codeless, which are particular sets of values which have been created specifically by some authority to say these are the possible values for some set of content in a description. We can have subject heading lists, like when you have a library classification scheme, and so on and so on. And so there's a large number of things which are all controlled vocabularies of one sort or another. The question is, how do we make a controlled vocabulary? Well, let's ask Elaine Spanonius. A controlled vocabulary is making an artificial language out of a natural. That's a really elegant way to say it. The words we will use spontaneously in our ordinary discourse, our ordinary information acts, will be the natural ones for us. But they will be uncontrolled. They'll come from our natural language. We need to invent an artificial language which has a tighter repertoire of words, a tighter grammar for how those words are applied, tighter control over the context in which those words are applied. Okay? And that typically means to choose some authoritative form of a name or of a term, ensure that the name is distinctive in the context in which you're trying to apply the name, and then take all the different forms that you have and converge them, harmonize them by changing them to the authoritative names. All the variant names would be mapped, saying, don't use this term, use this term instead. So that's how we impose vocabulary control. Now that's really, really hard to do because most of the situation which is trying to control vocabulary is a situation where there's already a lot of words in use. And we're doing it kind of after the horse escaped the barn. We're saying, how can we fix these problems to make there be less vocabulary confusion than there already is? How can we basically stop the proliferation, stop the hemorrhaging of names, and get to a smaller number of names that we can control? So think about how names proliferate. The same person or entity or business entity or some whatever the thing you're trying to give a name to might use or could be given different names. And of course, sometimes people choose to have different names over time. Like for example, Aaron, did you choose to have different names over time? You chose to change your name. You didn't have to, but you chose to change your name. So people who knew you in your previous name might not know that Aaron Knight is the same person as the person they knew before, who had a different name. Okay? Sometimes have the name changed because someone tells them what the name has to be. The German government says you have to change your name to this when you get married. You're not allowed to have hyphens of a certain type or something like that. Right? They may change your name. Chinese government changes your name for you. We learned about that a few weeks ago. Different names also emerge from what we might charitably call computational processes involving names. Like, for example, when someone wants to send you a piece of junk mail, right? They may buy a mailing list, and try to somehow generate harvest names from various sources, and then try to send you some mail, and they may generate some strange name for you, then that becomes a name that's in some name repository that you get used in some of the context. I mean, it's hard to believe, but there are people that have hundreds of different forms of their names, okay? Especially people that have things like lots of names to begin with, names with foreign spellings, names with prefixes and suffixes like Von and Van and the Third and Doctor and, you know, so on, the very right reverend and colonel and these kind of things as parts of a name. Caused all sorts of havoc with these kind of computational processes, sorting, and what's the sorting rule you're going to apply, and things like that. The abbreviation of what you're going to apply. And so you have people like Goethe. This is all the same guy. Turns out that shows up in books and prints about 20 different ways, because different places that have talked about him have done his name differently. So this is the same person who has many different names, and we could ask, well, which one is the authoritative form of this name? Well, someone probably has rules for that sort of thing, right? The library scientists have thought about this. They probably have rules for that sort of thing. So that's a problem which we can solve, because we say wherever we have different versions of the same, whether it's the same person's name, we should fix them and somehow say, this is the right version of that name. It's a little harder to solve the problem where two people have the same name. So, John Muir isn't exactly the strangest name in the world, but there's more than one John Muir out there. And so one of them wrote books about Yosemite and wilderness, and some of them wrote books about fixing Volkswagens. Okay, I used to have the Zen of the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, whatever it was called, or How to Keep Your Volkswagen Alive, when I was in the 1970s. It was by this guy, John Muir. It was his pen name. But he also seems to write books about national parks 80 years before. Pretty interesting guy, right? So, I mean, this problem you see is that how many names should you have? Should you associate with a document information objects? Which one is the main one? Is there some kind of canonical form you want to put that name in? And if you have other forms, how do you kind of deal with them? How do you point to them? So this is the kind of question we want to solve with authoritative name control, vocabulary control for names. And as you heard a little bit about in the lecture on the 16th of September, a long time ago, there is this thing called the AACR, the Anglo-American Cataloging Rules, which has rules for this sort of thing, how you determine the number of name entities, and so on and so on. And so there are official bodies whose job is to help enforce authority control for names, to create and maintain the set of terms that have been chosen as the established or standard names. And the Library of Congress maintains such a file called the authority file. It's in marked format, not surprisingly, for the names of all these entities, persons, corporates, geographical names, and so on, titles of works and so on. And they say we should use as the predominant form the name that is used the most, okay? And that we should then point to that from other forms of the name. So that's something I would like to do, because essentially it says that you can solve the naming problems if you say this is the name you should be using, or the first one you used, and then let's point to that in the authority name file of the Library of Congress. And that means that we have identified that we now pointed to some person, presumably, who has a name, and that's going to be the authoritative name. So we made the world, you know, referential. This name refers to this person. So let's do that. I went to the Library of Congress name file, and I was kind of intrigued by the fact that I thought I had an authoritative name, but I don't. When I look myself up in the Library of Congress, something which is plausibly my name, like Robert Glushko, and I look for it, lo and behold, there are two Robert Glushkos. Maybe they're different people for all I know, right? So first I look for Glushko Robert J., who that person is, and that looks like someone I recognize because he's written a book that I actually wrote. So that must be me, Document Engineering. So my authoritative name, the Library of Congress, is Robert J. Glushko. And that makes sense, because that's the name I've used almost everything I've written, Robert J. Glushko. I use Robert J. Glushko because I have a son who has his name Robert M., and I want to make sure he doesn't get credit for anything I've written. He's not going to get credit for my thesis, for example, the PhD thesis. I'll make sure that he doesn't get credit for stuff that he didn't write. Okay? So, but who's this Glushko Robert John character? Well, I look up him. He has the same birthday as me. And he wrote my PhD thesis. So wait a second. There's two me's in the Library of Congress. And that's just me, right? So I suspect that a lot of people have more than two entries in the Library of Congress. And the problem is that because we want to ensure that PhD thesis are uniquely identifiable, you are always required by most universities to have your complete name, first name, middle name, last name in the title of your thesis. But that's almost never the case when you write a book. So you must always use your first name and last name, or first name and initial. So the conventions for how you name an author are different in PhD theses and regular books. And sure enough, the Library of Congress is confused by that, which I think is a pretty standard rule. So that is a little bit surprising to me. So I have a split personality with two authoritative me's in the Library of Congress. Now, but that's nothing. Okay? There's this guy named John Creasy out there who puts me to shame. John Creasy in the Library of Congress is a very interesting dude. And you know who John Creasy is? You ever heard of John Creasy? John Creasy is a very prolific person as a writer. He's so prolific that he has 223 books that have his name on them. A lot of books, okay? But what's interesting about that is that most of them don't have his name on them only. They have his name and somebody else's name on them because he wrote them under other people's names. These are pseudonyms of John Creasy. John Creasy wrote like Pulp Fiction Western novels, I think. Okay? And if you know about that sort of genre, you know, you crank them out as fast as you can and they have very tiny prop variation because you buy them in airports and things like that. And, you know, they're not really deep literature. So if you read the same book 12 times, you might not know if it's written by a different author. Okay? So sure enough, John Creasy has written 223 books under 20 different names. Notice that most of them had the same date of birth and death as him. So there's probably a good possibility that it really was him doing all that, okay? But there's a couple of interesting exceptions here. One of them is J.J. Merrick. Now, J.J. Merrick, of all the pseudonyms of John Creasy, doesn't have the same date of birth and date of death as John Creasy, and that's because of something very peculiar about J.J. Merrick. J.J. Merrick, let's see what we know about J.J. Merrick. J.J. Merrick has his authoritative name entry. Wait a second. I thought he was a pseudonym. Well, he is a pseudonym. But the problem is, somebody got confused in the Library of Congress and made him into a person. So, here's now an imaginary person who was a pseudonym of John Creasy, who is now a person in the Library of Congress named Authority File. And he actually writes, apparently, as a pseudonym of William Vivian Butler. So, notice that William Vivian Butler has a different name, different date of birth and death date than John Creasy did. So I said, well, who is this guy, William Vivian Butler? William Vivian Butler, it turns out, is a real person, okay, who wrote some books using J.J. Merrick as a pseudonym. So you're saying, what's up with that? What's happening there? What is going on here? So, Creasy wrote some books. Some of them were using the pseudonym J.J. Merrick. Then what happened next? Creasy died, but there was a demand for books by J.J. Merrick. He was a popular writer. Give me the next J.J. Merrick book when it comes out. So somebody hired William Butler to write more books and put J.J. Merrick's name on them. Okay? All I know is that so we have two real people and one fake person. The fake person actually has a record as a real person, and the real person here is listed as a pseudonym of a fake person. So even though William Butler is a real person, he's not listed as a pseudonym here because they got these guys mistaken here. Who's the real one? Who's the pseudonym? So I guess the point was that you want to believe that having an authoritative name makes you a person, but in fact, their authoritative names are hard to come by than you think, and some of them don't belong to persons. Some of them belong to fake people. What I'm trying to make is, with this kind of long and admittedly forced example, is that naming is hard to get right. Okay? And so, one reason why it's hard to get right is because, you know, names appear in all kinds of different forms and contexts. So, you know, suppose I could say, well, am I Robert J. Glushko or am I Robert John Glushko, right? If I spell my name in Chinese, it looks different than if I spell it in English. So when you spell out Mao Zedong, okay, is it spelled you know, with a Z or with a T, okay? There are lots of things I could do differently here, right? And they're sometimes my fault because I may have chosen, I may have written a book in China, translated into Chinese, and that's my name will appear in Chinese on the cover of that book. And now I have a Chinese variant of my name. How many people do you know who are classmates of yours who have people from China who have, or Korea, they have their English names, right? Do you have one, Joyce? It's Joyce. Is Joyce your real name? What's your real name? See, so you have a name which is hard to pronounce, so you go by Joyce because you don't want to confuse these poor Americans that can't use your language properly. But now you have, people think, so Joyce, are you going to get a degree with Joyce on it or with your real name? Okay. Who's that person? She never took a class from me. So you see how there can be problems like that. Now, of course, it's not always your fault. Here's a very interesting example where you have, there's a book by Russell Norvig, Canning, and Malik called Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach, written in 1995. And it's been cited at least lots of different times. It's been cited about 300 different times. No, 8,100 times. Sorry, a lot of times. It's a very popular book. I'm sorry, I'm reading it wrong. It's been cited 8,181 times, this book. Must be the Bible of AI, right? Okay. However, 94 of them call it AI Modern Approach by Norvig Russell. That's different order of the authors, and in fact, it is. Okay. Here you have, the publisher is allegedly Hall in Englewoods, when in fact it's Prentice Hall in Englewood, New Jersey. So we mangle the metadata around the publisher. You get the point. So, you know, maybe we gave Google a little bit too much grief this morning or the other day about the quality of the metadata they're using, because some of that metadata was created by people doing stuff like this, and so Google finds the wrong record and it's going to have the wrong metadata. The question is, how do we fix these problems? Well, the problem we have is, how do we know when two different forms really denote the same person or the same object or same entity? Okay, we call this a name matching problem. And it's kind of ironic that it also has four other names. The same problem goes by five names: co-reference resolution, duplicate detection, record language, linkage, and merge purge. So depending on what specialty of natural language processing or database management you're in, you call the same problem by different names. That's kind of ironic. I'd like you to appreciate that. So this problem occurs in lots of different places: database maintenance, text retrieval, data mining, so on and so on. And so, I mean, you read about it in law enforcement and counterterrorism. Where else does it show up? It shows up in population statistics, like counting people in censuses, right? Doing computational biology, counting organisms, counting instances of things. Whenever you're trying to count things, you have to make sure you're counting the same things more than once. So you use their name to figure out if they're unique or not. But again, this is really hard. Okay, it's hard because people misspell names. It might have been misspelled in the original. It might have been transcribed wrong. It might have been scanned wrong. Maybe that piece of dirt on the paper turns an O into an I. Things like that, right? Clearly, we have what we would call differences in phonological to orthographic mapping, meaning we have the same sound pattern can be spelled different ways. Okay. You know the story about G-H-O-T-I, the string in English, G-H-O-T-I? That could be pronunciation of fish, because there are contexts of use in which G-H is pronounced like pho, like an enough, and so on. So G-H-O-T-I could be a spelling of fish, if you get a little fanciful about it. So the point is, there's more than one way to spell things in English, and that different in spelling the sound mappings will create proliferation of name forms. We have language transliteration. We try to take a sound in one language and record it in another. We have things like, is the sound that the capital of China, Beijing or Peking? I mean, apparently it's closer to Beijing, but the first people who tried to write it down misheard it, and they wrote down Peking, and then they finally people said it should be closer to Beijing, so they started spelling it differently. But that means we still have all these old Pekings, like Peking duck. I don't know why you don't call it Beijing duck to be consistent, but we don't. And even more interesting is that the nature of these problems differs in different languages. Spanish is much easier to spell than English, so there are fewer variant forms in Spanish than English. So we have some of the techniques to attack these problems are language independent, some of them are language dependent. Because again, different languages have different amounts of these problems. We all know about nicknames and variant forms. I mean, all of us have names that our parents or our spouses or friends use for us that are not the names we use in class, or on our birth certificates, or on our other official documents. I've been called all sorts of things. I was called Galoshes for a long time, for example. And I actually answered to that. Galoshes, or Goulash, you know, because my name is sort of hard for people to get right for a while. I was called Bobby G for a long time, because when I was in kindergarten, there were five Bobby, so we had Bobby G, Bobby A, Bobby D, that kind of thing, right? So I had to go with my last initial for a long time. Names change. I mean, there's a really cute site I found last year which shows the real names of people before they change them. And of course, a lot of them are people like famous people who like decided their name wasn't good enough and they had to change something more actor sounding or something. So this, of course, is Jennifer Anastakis, because that sounds harder to do than Jennifer Aniston. There's an actor named The Rock. You know who The Rock is? You know what his name is? The Rock is called, where is he here? Oh, maybe he's under The Rock. Anyway, but The Rock has a name like Dwayne or something. Okay, Dwayne. Okay, so it's not like Dwayne isn't sort of as enough a Rocky name as The Rock is. So again, there's this issue about did you change your name? And of course, people change their names for lots of reasons. A little bit trickier is when countries change their names. Countries change their names when they declare their independence. Let's say sometimes you go from being Rhodesia to what? Zimbabwe, right? Okay. So we have names like that. Abyssinia is today called Ethiopia. Okay. The Gold Coast is today called Ghana or Liberia. Nubia is today called Sudan, and so on. Right now, this is not just historically kind of interesting and cute, it has a real important implications for doing things like history and political science and economics and so on. If I want to say, gee, I'm interested in whether our investments made by the World Bank or the IMF or by governments in Africa have made a difference in the economy of this country, have improved the standard of living, I need to find data about the economy of Zimbabwe as a baseline or whatever it is, or some other country. I look and there is no Zimbabwe before 19 whatever it was, right? The place didn't exist. It existed, but it didn't have a name that we could use. So we have this problem what's called provenance. You know, can we track the name back over time so we can find the appropriate information or data sets? Because the names have changed. What's even more fascinating is that different languages have different rules for how names combine and how names change when you have children, when you get married and so on. I mean, think about things like Russia where we have Ova and, you know, the Ivanova is the daughter of Ivan. Ivanovich is the son of Ivan, right? Those kind of things where you have, you know, John's son was John's son. So you had these names where suffixes and affixes were tacked on names as families, you know, grew. So the person's surname actually changed from generation to generation. That causes trouble with your family tree, okay? Part of why it's sort of interesting to find your family tree, because your family changes name every generation by design, okay? All kinds of complicated rules in Spanish about this, in Chinese about this, Korean about this, okay? Then, of course, you have things like definite descriptions and metonymy, which make it hard to match names. If I say, the President of the United States said, okay, and I say, Barack Obama said, is that the same person or a different person? Well, what day is it? Okay? So, you know, that information only means the same person if you have nothing about the effectivity of that definite description. Who was the President of the United States on such a date? Okay? Things like that are important. And again, metonymy, if I say the White House said, who is the White House referred to? It might be referred to the press secretary. But of course, we really don't mean that. We mean the executive branch of the U.S. government, the president part, said this. Okay? So again, there's how you bind that is pretty tricky. So we have some of the things we talked about are things that are solved by culture in some sense. There are rules that the culture has, and so in some sense, the solution will only come when the culture says, enough is enough, let's stop having these kind of strange names, or stop having these rules where your name changes every generation, and so on. But there are technical approaches to solving name matching problems. Most of them have to do with some notion of similarity, of saying, if how close together are these two things that might be the same? And I'll figure out ways to measure that similarity. And if the similarity is within some threshold, then I'll assume that they're really the same name. The most common one used is a measure of orthographic similarity or edit distance, where you say, here are two names. How many different characters would I have to change or shift or transpose or some other change, like edit, how many edit instructions would I have to run to turn string A into string B? And that is gives you sort of a measure of the distance between two strings. So John Sun and John Sen are only one character apart, the E and the O. John Sun, J-O-H-N-S-O-N, and Johnson with J-O-H-N-N, double O or double N, I think we might be three or four characters apart. Johansson might be five characters apart because it's got not only additional letters, but it's got some ones that are missing and so on. So it's like lining up and other things. Very clever algorithms do things like weight the likelihood of this particular error being made based on word frequency, word order, and so on. So for example, B-O-O-K is pretty close, actually. It's B-O-O-K-E. You think that's one letter away, right? Because book, you add one E to it, becomes book and book with the E. Okay? Like cook and cook, let's say. It's actually closer in kind of edit space to have B-O-K-K. Because it's very common when you're typing to mistype by doubling the wrong letter. So you're typing B-O-O-K, instead you say B-O-K-K. That's a very easy error to make when you type. And that's easier to make than to add an extraneous E to something. Okay? So, in some sense, you're using this notion of typing error frequency, which is based on all kinds of things, based on the cognitive model of typing, based on the keyboard arrangement, all kinds of other things, which gets into this notion of distance. In fact, that kind of science of typing mistakes is actually really important in things like spam detection. When you want to see how likely is this string to be a spam string, look at things like edit distance to real names and things like that. So another thing we can measure, in addition to orthographic similarity, is pronunciation similarity. In which case, we essentially say, If we have two names which are appear as text strings, let's try to encode them as how they sound. And if we encode things with a function that reduces the number of characters, we're essentially doing a hash function into smaller character sets, which basically finds things that sounded like now have the same encoding. They're spelled differently. So you imagine you're typing someone's name, you type the way it sounds. If you misspell it, you'll get it back by doing this sound hash function. And the most common hash function used for this purpose is soundex. And this is, let's see if I can do this. Okay, so a really simple one. If I say, for example, I want to find K-N-I-G-H-T, Aaron Knight's last name, it'll calculate the soundex code, K523. And if I type in N-I-G-H-T, sorry, nope, not that one. If I type in N-I-G-H-T, it'll have the same soundex. No, it won't. Interesting. I guess it's waiting the first character. Here's what I was going to use for Jessica Hemmerly. Hemmerly, who's not here, but she will listen to this lecture at some point, I hope. Right, Jess? So Hemmerly spells the name something like this. H-E-M-M-E-R-L-E. Is that it? L-E. How do you spell your name, Jess? H-E-M-M-E-R-L-E, I think. Hemmerly. Soundex code H-564. We could add an L to that, and it wouldn't change it at all. We could take out one of the M's, and it wouldn't change it at all. Okay, so you see, three different spellings of the same name have the same soundex hash, and that's how we might be able to infer that they really are the same person that was being written down about. Okay? So, again, this sort of thing takes place all the time, and some of the people who do it the most are people who do mail to you. So, think of this question. If I got, I want to determine which things are duplicates of another. And of course, if I have additional information, I can use that additional information as a way to increase my precision of determining whether something is a duplicate or not. But again, this is harder than it looks even. So here I see the Smith, and there's always a gazillion Smiths in any directory of any kind. I'm sure that Kate Smith knows that. So here you see a bunch of Smiths, and we say, the question is, which one of these are probably the same person? Okay? So we look at the first five, and you see that the first five records, and they're all different. But if you look at them, you notice that there might be able to be some transformation on those records that would make them actually look more alike. So, in fact, the second record doesn't have a name, but if you look at it, imagine it was shifted over somehow, wrapped around, maybe that Smith would have ended up in the name field rather than the phone field. Likewise, the second Smith, SMTH, isn't spelled right. They're missing the I, but they have the same address as someone else who was a Smith that we know about. And they even have the same phone number, subject to the hyphen. Maybe that's the same person. Okay? The fourth Smith lives at 13th Street, but it's spelled out 13th, T-H-I-R, so on, rather than the number 13. But again, that might be the same person. It has the same phone number, doesn't have the same area code, but we could look up and know that Chicago has 312 area codes. That probably is the same person. Okay? So we can kind of fix those records, as we do in the bottom, and get a lot closer to, just by doing some sort of sensible transformations, and find out that they may be the same person with duplicate records. Now, of course, there are two different phones here, so maybe that person has two phone numbers, or maybe one of the phone numbers is not right. And how would we decide which one to keep if we wanted to make a decision? We could vote and say which one comes the most times. We could say, what's the latest one, right? The latest one might be the best, or the one that occurs the most frequently could be the best. You could argue for both of those. Again, it depends on how much you trust the latest update. Who made the latest update? Was it done by Smith or was it done by somebody else? Okay. Now, would you delete the other records if you decide that 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are really the same person? Would you delete those records? No, you wouldn't. They could be the five different people with the same. We don't know their first names, do we? You got. I was trying to slip that one by you. Way to go. Okay. Could be the same family. They're just all different people, right? So the worst case, you'd want to say, well, they're all duplicates, but I'm not going to delete them because I don't know enough to be sure. You might mark them as, don't delete, possibly it's the same, but not sure. Okay? Because again, if someone comes in and says, I'm Kate Smith, and I've been my phone number, you go, oh, ooh, they have first names too, don't they? And then you realize there was more missing data. Okay. So again, there's a lot of issues going on here. One that I want to talk about just for fun is this notion of that we touched on a little bit when we got to the Dublin Core today about on the 16th about authorship. Authorship is a really complicated idea, and so if you want to say this is the author of some work, okay, an author could be a single person, could be a single corporate entity, there could be unknown authors, there could be anonymous authors, there could be pseudonyms, there could be works which are intentionally ascribed to different people than they actually were, or not, as the case may be, like we're hiding the fact that the drug companies helped write some of those articles. We could have, you know, all kinds of issues here that make it difficult to have unique names and things like author fields. Also true about places. So, the same place may have different names, variant form. So this is St. Petersburg expressed in English, Russian, and I guess French. Okay. The same city could have different names based on the country that happened to be occupying at the time. Names change. I do not understand what's going on in India, where they go from Bombay to Mumbai, or the, you know. Can you shed some light on why we change names of India?
Yeah,
Bangalore is not called Bengaluru.
Yeah, these were all colonial names. They're all Mumbai and then.
Okay, so the colonial names are being deprecated. So we're sort of, this is a nationalist thing to kick out the English names, like kick out Peking and make it Beijing. Okay. That seems fair. Okay. There are plenty of places which actually are different places that have the same name. It's a problem with places like Vienna, Virginia and Vienna, Austria. There are 50 Springfields. Who lives in the Springfield? Who lives in Springfield? The Simpsons. Remember last year there was this contest when they had the Simpsons movie about which city should be allowed to open up the movie? And apparently had some kind of competition, and Springfield and I think Maine got to open up the movie. Is it Springfield, Maine? Yeah.
Vermont.
Springfield, Vermont got to open up the movie. They must have told the best Simpson joke or something. There's this problem of, as we said before, but the names changing over time like anachronism, like what was Germany before 1870? If we say, I'm going to go to Germany, well, Germany wasn't a place until 1870 when it was unified under as a Bismarck, I guess. Okay. Where is the boundaries of Silicon Valley, the Midwest, the Great Plains? You know what Silicon Valley consists of? Depends who you ask. If you ask some people, they'll say Silicon Valley is Santa Clara County and southern part of Alameda County, like Milpitas and Fremont and, you know, Santa Clara and Palo Alto and San Jose and things like that. Some people say Silicon Valley includes San Francisco. We had all those dot-com companies in it with that sort of Silicon Valley-ish, right? Some people think Berkeley kind of is Silicon Valley at times. You say, well, Berkeley's kind of, you know, part of the ground zero of the internet revolution. We invented, you know, a lot of stuff here, you know. And, of course, some people think the Pleasanton's part of Silicon Valley, because as you drive out 580, you have this long string of kind of high-tech companies that keep going out there toward Pleasanton, and they're like Oracle and so forth. So they're obviously part of Silicon Valley, too. And finally, you have the problem of unstable boundaries. And not that the names change, but the actual boundaries change. Poor Poland, okay, has been like a piece of rubber his boundaries get pulled east and west, and who is sort of controlling it. So Poland was a lot farther east before, and then the Russians came in and decided they wanted to kind of punish Germany after the war, so they grabbed a bunch of what was Germany and made it into Poland, and did a lot of resettlement to make that kind of work. And of course you see Germany now, East and West Germany disappearing and the boundaries moving around too. And of course the Balkans, right? So countries kind of come and go. The Balkans were countries and they disappeared for 20 years, now they're back as countries. Things like that. So we have this problem of how do we know what places are should be called? So we have notions about things like gazetteers, where we have things like authority files for places, maybe using latitude and longitude coordinates as the identifier, and it helps us figure out the places that are the same and differentiate those places which are different. Problem with gazetteers, though, is that they're often contaminated by, if you're not careful, by names that are put on maps that are fake places. So, you know that map makers make up fake places? Why would they do that? They do it for copyright reasons. They often invent fake places so they can tell whether maps have been stolen by somebody or not. And again, there are places that are really not real places that show up on maps because they think it would be awkward not to have the map without those places. So if you ever looked at a world globe, here's an interesting exercise for you. Western Australia is a very, very empty place. Between Adelaide and Perth is about 2,000 miles of absolute nothingness. There's like nothing. There's like three gas stations in Western Australia for like 1,500 miles. Okay? But it would look kind of weird to have this like blank spot on the globe. Because in that same space, you have all of Western Europe. And you have London, Paris, Rome, you know, Madrid, Frankfurt, and Berlin kind of thing, right? And so they want to have like put some spaces. So they actually have, most globes have like places on them that are like gas stations. Some of them are even uninhabited gas stations. They're places that they want to fill up the blank space on the globe, so they're there. Okay. And finally, there's a kind of authority control for time periods problem, which is you say, just as we have the names of place people are not always authoritative, and the names of places are not always authoritative, you know, some places have unstable time periods. What does, you know, what is the Elizabethan period, okay? What is the Neolithic period? Turns out it's different in different places. In the Neolithic period has a different time course in China and in South America because people invented stone tools at different times in those places. So it's not, it doesn't map uniquely to years, okay? Did the Elizabethan period die the day that Queen Elizabeth died? No. Okay, well, maybe it did to some people. That's when it, but it was. It probably extends a little bit more than that. The Civil War, well, which one? The Renaissance, which one? Okay? The Renaissance moved through Europe at different times. Okay? How about the war we used to call the War to End All Wars? Which one was that? It was the World War I, which was first called the Great War, the World to End All Wars. And then it wasn't the World to End All Wars. It had to rename it retroactively as World War I. So that's the kind of problem we see, you know, with any domain where the names can be created from lots of different sources, lots of different points of view, for lots of different purposes. You're not going to have authoritative name forms. It's going to cause problems. So we want to have identifiers. So identifiers are a special kind of name where we have forced it to be you to have refer to one and only one thing. So identifier, by definition, refers to only one or only one thing within some scope. The problem is, of course, that the same thing can have more than one identifier. So how many do you have that are allegedly unique identifiers? We have a social security number, you have a student number, you have a driver's license, you have a health ID probably, you have a passport, you have a credit card, you have an airline frequent traveler name, number. You probably have a dozen or more unique identifiers attached to you. And that's a problem. And of course, the same identifier can mean different things in different contexts or different times. I mean, we have the problem that people use the social security number for things they shouldn't be used for. And the ISBN in the bookstore used for different purposes than the ISBN in the library, perhaps. We have this notion of a persistent identifier if it resolves to the same referent indefinitely or as long as is needed. But, and this, I love this quote from that paper, persistence is not a function of technology, it's a function of organizations. Persistence is a kind of promise about an identifier. It's not intrinsic in the technology, okay? It's something just saying, you know, think of how you use URLs, okay? I mean, URLs, do you use URLs to point to a place or a logical place or a physical place, right? I mean, are they written to be persistent or are they written to be, you know, the whole idea about rest and about, you know, cool URLs don't change. That's what the rest cool kids say, right? Okay? That we have a resource we know we can go back to because the identifier that gets to it won't have changed. You can think of this as kind of interoperating over time, interoperating with the future, okay, as opposed to just making something work right now. Will it work in the future at some unspecified time or within some range of future times? And finally, we can distinguish what you might call unstructured or dumb identifiers, which have no inherent meaning based on their values, with those which are structured or intelligent, like the ISBN, which the ISBN, it can be decomposed into different parts that reflect the publisher and so on. So there's like a namespace that the publisher owns, and I just lost my connectivity, didn't I? All right, we'll go back to that. Okay. The Social Security number used to, in fact, be an intelligent identifier. It used to be that they were assigned by local offices. And so when I was born, you could tell where you were from by the Social Security number. And they signed them to offices starting with the Northeast, closest to Washington, D.C., not surprisingly, and moving westward. So people who are old, if they have low Social Security numbers, they're from the East Coast, they were born. If they have high ones, they were probably born on the West Coast. That's no longer true. But since 1972, they all come from the same one facility. This is the name, the authority control for SSNs. But until before then, there were blocks of them given to different cities and different offices. And over time, the ISBN has gone the other direction. It's gone from being smart, you know, to being dumb, because now instead of being publishers, ISBNs using them to identify parts of the publication in their namespaces, you go to Starbucks and find ISBN on cookies, right? They put them on their biscotti so they can track the inventory. So now you can find a ISBN that is something you eat. It's no longer something you find in the library. So again, you've looked at these things, but originally this is a 10-digit system where 978 is a prefix, I'm not sure why, 0 is the country code, 8352 here is the publisher, 5555 is the publication, and 4 is a check digit that maybe didn't screw up the previous ones, okay? I don't understand 978 there, but it's there, okay? Maybe it's to kind of register, get something to calibrate or something. All right, code lists. Code lists are a special kind of identifier where we have constrained sets of values that are entirely arbitrary, and they mean only by what they refer to. So this is, in fact, one of the very few places in the world where the world is fragrant as opposed to Wittgensteinian. talked about that the other day about the meaning of things. When you have a code list, the codes themselves had no natural meaning. Sometimes identifier use had some pre-existing meaning and then we sort of reassigned it. Here's a case where their meaning is established only by reference, often by abbreviations. So we have, you want to use code lists if they exist when you have a vocabulary or metadata system because it will promote consistency and eliminate ambiguity. So there's some that you would have to use if you were going to describe things like languages or countries or currencies because they're established by international bodies like the ISO. And sure enough, ISO currency codes, things like the Afghani, the AF, or the Euro, or the Bhutan rupee, all have specialized currency codes that you want to use to make sure when you said, this is the currency I'm using, and this is the amount, that was completely unambiguous about how much you were talking about because you were specifying the currency in a standard way. This is one that you know a lot about because you see that when you fly, the IATA port codes, these are all the places that a port can be, namely airports or ports. This is a fascinating code list. Thousands of named places that refer to places that like a ship or a plane can go. But the best part of the story is Keltz reinforced the idea that these are completely arbitrary, that they're assigned by institutional actors, their institutional classification systems, institutional semantic systems. And I'm going to point to a very interesting part of this code space, namely the whys. If you go to the whys in this space, you see something very curious, which is that the whys all belong to a certain country. And you're going, why is it that the whys all belong to Canada? You know, YVR is the Vancouver airport. The Toronto airport is YTZ. Okay? London, Ontario, YXU. You're going, what's wrong with like SFO for San Francisco, right? LAX for Los Angeles, JFK for John F. Kennedy Airport. Why are these Canadians using these stupid Ys? Anyone have an idea? I told the story last year, so some of you might remember from last year at the TAs. You might make a guess, Kate, why the Canadians got the Ys? Why they used the Ys in Canada? They didn't show up at the standards meeting. And they got people mad at them for that, and they said, you guys don't want to come to our meetings? We'll give you the Ys. Deal with it. So instead of being able to say, I'd like to have YVR for Vancouver, thank you very much. I'm sorry, Vancouver, V-A-N or something like that. They got told, you get the Ys, that's your namespace, that deal with it. It was their sort of punishment for not going to the meeting. I haven't told that's a true story. It's a good story. Now, those are all external code lists because they're maintained by some entity or organization outside of your control, like ISO or ANSI or someone like that. What's interesting when you design a vocabulary is that you can invent your own code sets when you see the areas that you can control and define. This is really useful because you may decide that you can provide more precision in your description of things by having controlled vocabularies for things in your domain. So for example, if I wanted to have a vocabulary that described things on campus, I would want to have a list of legal places like legal classrooms, legal facilities. I might have a facilities list. Okay? I might have instructor list. Things like I could have student IDs. I could do a lot of things I could use to make sure that my data is of higher quality because I can enforce a controlled vocabulary of things that I can see in my domain. So often you can invent these things as a way to improve the precision of your descriptions. And I want to end with just a little bit of discussion about this case study that you all read, or that you will all read. Fascinating paper called Operation Clean Data. And this is an interesting case study. It has a number of case studies that you'll read about. I'm going to talk about one of them, which is the one about the British military. The British military, when they went to war in Iraq, discovered or anticipated, fortunately, some problems in their supply chains for information, and they discovered that they had different things, different warehouses had used different part, the same part number for different things, and the same part number for different parts of the number for the same things. So they had both bad things happening, same for different and different for same. And they did this because in 1940, when England was being bombed by the Germans during the Second World War, they had this fear that a lucky bomber would wipe out the British military supplies. So they took their big warehouse and made a bunch of small warehouses. When they did that, over time, of course, each warehouse invents its own numbering scheme for the stuff it has in it. And now you have a bunch of small warehouses with incompatible data. So the data is dirty. So for example, you might have different words or units. So you might have 250 liter drums or 250 1 liter drums. Okay, which one are you getting? Maybe using the same term used for both of them or something like that. And so essentially it's a lack of or failure to comply with standards. So they went in and they did all the things we've talked about so far, identifying homonyms and synonyms, using various kinds of concordance and profiling software to find variations of the things, and they tried to fix their data, identifying duplicates, so on and so on. And they fixed their data, and that was good because when they went to war in Iraq, they didn't ship, you know, toilet paper when they wanted guns. Okay? It'd be a bad thing to have one and need the other. In both directions, I think. Okay. But what's funny about this is that we didn't learn from them because last year, you might remember, Joyce probably remembers it because she's from Taiwan, the case where we sent missile parts to Taiwan by mistake, and we were supposed to send helicopter batteries to the Taiwanese military, and instead what we sent them was nuclear warheads, fuses. And of course, the mainland Chinese got very upset about this. They thought we were trying to arm Taiwan to take over the mainland. It was a mistake because the warehouse had the wrong number on something. So they said, we want to have some of these parts, and they shipped nuclear warheads instead of batteries. 202 in the news story, one of my favorites. So, let me summarize today's lecture. Naming is hard. Naming is challenging. Naming is contentious because there's often a lot of stake at it. People have their own view of the world. They want to change it. The uncontrolled words people use to describe things or concepts are embodied in their experiences. And so they're going to be different or even bad with respect to the words that some other person might use. So we have to invent a controlled vocabulary, namely an artificial language, to be used in place of the natural language we would use to facilitate agreement in some context and for some purposes. And with that, thank you for coming to this lecture. Thank you for listening to the lecture. I'll look forward to talking to you in a couple of days when you get around to the lecture on the 23rd.